Why did you become a communist?
Oh, why did I become a communist? I was born 1913. When I was a growing up boy, it was after the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917. It is difficult to imagine today what a tremendous fund of expectation that revolution arose in the world, brought into the world. It was such a great fund of confidence in that revolution that it existed in full strength in the throughout the 20s and 30s until Stalin, with his horrible repressions and terrors, started really undermining it. I grew up in that time, and I grew up in a country which was a democratic country. Czechoslovakia was the only Central European country which started in 1918 as a democracy and remained a democracy alone in the whole era, sphere, until it was destroyed when its allies, its friends, allied themselves with her enemies in 1938 after Munich. I grew up in that, in those 20s and 30s. When I came to the university, it was 1931. It was the time of the great economic crisis, tremendous unemployment in that over-industrialized Czechoslovakia. Don't forget that Czechoslovakia was one of the 10 most industrialized countries in the world at that time. And I saw that unemployment among the young people, especially students, and so on. And 1933, Hitler came to power in Germany. And that was the last straw which brought me into the communist student organization, the communist movement.
Can I jump now to the period after the war, when the Communist Party returned, the Communist Party leadership returned from Prague, from Moscow to Prague. What were the aims of the Communist Party leadership at that period?
Yes, you must know what preceded during the war, before the party leadership returned from Moscow. You know that the Communist Party in Czechoslovakia was, again, the only legal Communist Party that existed, hardly with any interruptions, from 1921, when it was formed, until it was suppressed after Munich. That was, again, a unique phenomenon in Central Europe. And if we later compare the positions of these communists in, let's say, Hungary or Poland with Czechoslovakia, we must take this into account, that the Communist Party became an accepted member or component of the political system of the country. It was against Munich and went down as an anti-Munich, anti-capitulation party, capitulation towards Hitler, which increased its standing in the eyes of the people. During the war, you know that the Communist International, immediately after the outbreak of the Second World War, came out with the instruction to its sections that this war is imperialist and they should work for the immediate ending of the war. That means in Hitler's interest. The Czechoslovak Communist Party by that time was illegal, and those instructions from Moscow came late and were not very much taken into account. Those instructions, by the way, created a terrible crisis in the Communist Party of France, in the Communist Party of Great Britain, which until today feels the after effects.
When the Communist Party leadership came back
from Moscow, it was a leadership of a party which was very popular. Because again, in the resistance movement, the communists stood their men, they had tremendous losses, and so on and so on. Besides, Czechoslovakia is the only country of Central Europe which never had a common frontier with the Russians until 1945, and thus did not have any bitter memories from the past connected with the Russians. It was a genuinely friendly people, the Czechs and the Slovaks, towards the Russians from the past, from their history and so on. That friendship was not disturbed, troubled by anything. The Red Army came as the liberator, and the Soviet Union, and with it the Communist Party, was very popular in 1945.
But even though the Communist Party was very popular, it didn't, did it, wish to become a normal democratic party in a post-war Czechoslovak democracy?
No, it wished, and I am convinced it wished genuinely, to create a political system, a socialist political system in Czechoslovakia, different from the Stalinist system. Different from the Stalinist system. The leader of the party, Gottwald, who became then prime minister after the elections in 1946, repeated many times that what they want, what the Communist Party, what we want is a socialist system different from the Soviet Union, the socialism on the Czechoslovak way.
But it still meant that the party would be the only functioning political party, would have a political monopoly of power.
Not necessarily. That came after this monopoly of power. Introduction of the monopoly of power of the Communist Party came after February 1948, when the Communist Party took over the whole of power. And that was one of the crossroads of the Czechoslovak Communist Party, the introduction of the Stalinist system after February 1948.
And from sources inside Czechoslovakia, indigenous Stalinism, or did it come mainly from Stalin himself?
Both. It came mainly from Stalin, because at that time Stalin was convinced that a Third World War was imminent. He felt weaker as the potential enemies on the other side, and he was nervous about it, and among other things he wanted an absolute disciplining of his empire. That meant no differences in the political system anywhere. And the Czech communists, the Czechoslovak communists, accepted that without any misgivings or without any protest.
If they did that, what was the purpose then of the show trials and the terror directed against parts of the
Communist
Party
show trials. You see, from Stalin's point of view, and if I say Stalin, I don't mean only him personally, but the system he created. For Stalin, the Czechoslovakia was a dangerous member of his empire, because it had a very deep, very long-standing democratic experiences in every respect. It was the most westernized of his empire. And that is why it was necessary, from his point of view, to brutally drive out that tradition of Western-type democracy or democratic thought from Czechoslovakia. See, already in 1949 there was a trial in Hungary. This disciplining was done with the help of trials. We will talk about it in Czechoslovakia. In Hungary, the infamous Reich trial in 1949, and at that time already, the then leader of the Hungarian Communist Party, Rákosi, handed over to Gottwald a list of 60 names of so-called enemies of the state, demanding their arrest and their trials. My name was on that list as well, without my knowing it, of course. The argument was that Czechoslovakia was the center of all the conspirational, subversive activity against the Soviet system, against socialism, and that it is necessary to uproot that, I don't know how to call it, viper's nest. And that was the effect of it, was that brutal, most brutal set of trials, show trials in Czechoslovakia. The most brutal of them all. Because Czechoslovakia had to be re-educated by the most cruel means.
What happened to you? Personally?
What happens to me? Well, I was, you see, the people who were to be eliminated, there were categories of people. Imagine, Stalin thought a Third World War was possible. I have to do what I can to, prevent the worst for such an eventuality. Among other things, I have to put the, the heavy industry in a position of absolute priority, because that produces arms and so on. That means deforming the whole system of economy. And I have to be sure that the potential enemy will have no allies behind my back. So categories of people were established which had to be eliminated from positions of power, of influence.
What were these categories?
And these categories were people who lived, communists, old communists, who lived sometime in the West. Under that category came, among others, the ex-fighters of the Spanish International Brigades who were caught in Western Europe by the war. People who were able to fight against Hitler without being ordered by the Soviet Union or her allies. Partisans and so on. After the creation of the State of Israel, Jews, who were suspected even more of double loyalty. That was the lists of people without any respect to the individual man or woman, what he did or did not do, or what was his character, so those categories.
What category did you fall in?
I was an old communist, lived in the West in my first exile, was a Jew on all three counts.
And what happened to you exactly?
What happened to me? I was envoy of Czechoslovakia in Israel in 1949. I was then appointed minister to Sweden. I sent from Tel Aviv my personal belongings to Stockholm, and I stopped in Prague to be acquainted with a new agenda. And I was not allowed to travel to Stockholm any longer. And I was retained half a year, and then I was arrested at the end of 51, immediately after the ex-first secretary, general secretary of the party, Rudolf Slansky. And I was put into that horrible mill.
What were you actually physically tortured?
Not physically, but the psychological torture was enough to not to make the physical torture necessary. I was isolated for 1 year and a half, for 18 months, completely from the world, interrogated all the time, and then put to trial and sentenced to life imprisonment.
Leaping forward now, when the reform movement started in the 1960s, where did it come from in Czechoslovakia? What were the groups that started?
Oh, well, you see, that came gradually. It was a gradual development. A very important point is 1956, the 20th Congress of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union, with Khrushchev's criticism of Stalin and Stalin's crimes. Then at the beginning of the 1960s, Czechoslovakia suffered for the first time in the history of the so-called socialist countries a minus economic development. Because of, among other things, because of the end of friendship with China, with Mao's China, and so on. And that, at the same time, 1961, there was the party congress in Moscow, which increased the intensity of the anti-Stalinist criticism. So that the Czechoslovak party leadership with Novotny could not any longer withhold the de-Stalinization.
Who are the people inside the party and in society who started this whole movement towards the Prague Spring, reforming politics, reforming economies?
Oh, it came mainly from two sources, from the intellectuals and from the economists. I don't mean the intellectual economists, but from the economy. Because that was performed very badly at the beginning of the 60s, as I said already. And there was a tremendous dissatisfaction among the intellectuals of all sorts ever since soon after 1948, when all the illusions were suddenly lost.
What was the most important source? What was the most, of those two factors, what was the most important group, the important cause? Was it the economy, the poor performance of the economy?
Well, that came together, that flew together, you know, flowed together, because there were these elements there, this tension. Ever since 1956, the Novotny regime succeeded in suppressing criticism, in censoring newspapers, books, and taking punitive measures against individual intellectuals and so on, sending them from, I don't know, from an editorial post to a factory for a year or two and so on. So, re-education, we know it from the Far East.
Were there groups inside the party who were also...
And as soon as the party leadership was forced to think of the necessity of the economic reform, from that moment, the party apparatus divided into those who wanted an economic reform to succeed and those who preferred not to have any change because their position would be endangered. What? And there you had a division. In the 60s, before 68, if you wanted to hear the best anti-party jokes, you could have them in the party secretariat.
So was it a group inside the party that was actually leading the Prague?
And by the middle of 1968, the very important sections of the Central Committee of the party were convinced that the regime, Novotny's regime, as it existed, could not go any longer, because that would mean a complete collapse of the whole system.
The whole process of the Prague Spring was very rapid. Was there a point at which the party, as sometimes been said, the party and the Dubček, the reformers even, lost control of Czech society?
During 68? No, that was not the case. Dubček had, You see, Dubček's, well, probably greatest achievement, if you like, and from the point of view of some weakness, was that he refused during 1968 to use administrative methods of achieving what he wanted to achieve. That he was convinced and repeated it again and again and defended himself against pressures from his great allies. Dubček was convinced that he can achieve whatever was necessary by political means, not administrative oppressive measures. Although he was pressured towards using them, already at the meeting of the leaders of the communist of socialist countries in Dresden, he was pressurized to use administrative oppressive measures, and he refused. And he never lost control because he had all the levers of power in his hands. And whenever it would have been necessary, he would be able to use them, but he refused.
What was Dubček, you and the other reformers in the party, what were you basically trying to do? What was your immediate objective and your long-term objective?
Well, it was our immediate objective was to adapt the system in Czechoslovakia to Czechoslovakia's needs, possibilities and traditions. Very simply. We had the traditions of democracy. We had a very developed economy before 1945, which was destroyed partly by Stalin's policy of the Third World War. And we had a tremendous tradition of organized working class movement, which goes with the regime.
You talked, and Dubček and you and others talked a lot about the democratization of Czechoslovakia in the Prague Spring. But what exactly were the limits of this? You didn't imagine returning to a multi-party system, did you?
Not a multi-party system, but some sort of a multi-voiced system, let's say. The pluralist system of some sort, corresponding to the development of our society, because our society by 1968 was quite different from Western societies any longer. And it would be idle to take over a ready-made model of the Western democracy, as it was silly or criminal to take over Stalin's model for Czechoslovakia. We had to create something new, and the basis of it was the acknowledgement of the existence of interest groups within our society. You see, that is what Stalin denied. Stalin's great, fraud lied in the fact that he talked always about the moral political unity of the people. And he, as the voice of it or the leader of it, that means that he consciously did not want to recognize the existence of interest groups within society.
But you did not.
And we wanted to bring those back into the full play, to give them the possibility of voicing their interests and defending their interests.
But even so, within that system, the leading role of the party would still be maintained.
The leading role of the party would have been maintained, but in a quite different way, completely, basically different. The party would have to seek the confidence of the people every day with its work. For the time being, for the first phase of our democratization movement, we eliminated a struggle for power by the creation of the National Front, where all the organizations, all the representatives of the interest groups or group interests would come together and hammer out a common position to every problem.
What did you do, did you, Dubček and the reformers do, to provoke the Soviet intervention? What caused that?
We did not do anything to provoke the intervention. The intervention was came because the Soviet leadership of that day, the Brezhnev leadership, thought that we went too far, that we breached the allowed circumference of a socialist system as they conceived it.
And what particularly offended them from what you did?
Everything, really. They were very much offended that we suppressed, that we eliminated censorship. That was when Brezhnev came to the meeting of the leadership of the Soviet Union and Czechoslovakia in Chop, in Cherna at the frontier. He came every day with such high stacks of papers, cuttings of our newspapers. And he threw it at Dubček one after the other. Look what you are writing. Look, how is it possible in a socialist system and so on and so on. For instance, but I must add, and that is very important, that during the whole Prague Spring, during the whole months of our democratization movement, we did not endanger any vital interest of the Soviet Union. That must be repeated and must be really very strongly said again and again, because all accusations that the Czechoslovak democracy movement somehow represented a threat to the vital interest of the Soviet Union is nonsense and a lie.
How much do you think that the what happened in 68 with the Soviet Union invasion, how much did that affect how the Soviet Union viewed the whole of Eastern Europe for the whole of the 1970s?
Oh, the Soviet leadership took the suppression of the Prague Spring as an excuse to deprive the allies, the so-called socialist countries, of their sovereignty, even formally, in the so-called Brezhnev Doctrine, and in the pacts of alliance concluded with, let's say, Czechoslovakia in 1970, I think it was, and with East Germany, where the Soviet Union has the right in writing in an international pact to interfere in Czechoslovakia's internal affairs.
Do you, looking back now in 68, do you think if it happened now that Gorbachev would have intervened?
Oh, on the contrary, I am convinced that Gorbachev would give a great deal if he had today a successful Prague Spring. And because, you see, what he is trying to do is, to my mind, the clearest and greatest possible historical vindication of the rightness of the Prague Spring of 68. Because the power that suppressed us in 1968 is trying to do the same thing, because, as I repeated ever since 68, socialism has only one possibility of positive development, and that is democratization.
I would now like to go back to 1948. Why did the Social Democratic Party, which was very strong in Czechoslovakia, why did it allow the Communist Party to stage what in effect was a coup in 1948?
Oh, you see, the Social Democratic Party in 1948 was deeply divided. Between a pro-communist and anti-communist wing. And when the crunch came in 1948, the social democratic ministers in the cabinet did not resign, and gave the Communist Party, Gottwald, the well, formal argument that he had a majority in parliament, majority of one with the Social Democrats, and that his stance, his refusal to abdicate with the rest of the government was constitutional, that it was not a putsch, that it was not a coup d'etat. But 1948, it is necessary to note that in 1948 Czechoslovakia had no other way than to submit to Stalin, because he would not have accepted anything, even for the price of a new war. And all the non-communists or the anti-communist parties at that time did not have any alternative political concept. They couldn't. They tried, but they couldn't, because they did not exist.
Both when you initiated and were living through the Prague Spring, to what extent were you self-consciously looking over your shoulder and thinking, well, we must avoid the mistakes made in Hungary in 1956?
Oh yes, see, from our point of view, Hungary, in Hungary happened things which were very provocative for the Soviet Union. As you remember, there, very early in the movement, the movement turned against the members of the secret police, and they were lynched in the street, and so on and so on. We said that that counter-revolutionary forces came to the fore in the Hungarian Revolution, but not with us. And we will guarantee that that won't happen with us, because in our country the whole movement started from the top of the party, from the highest echelons of the party, from the Central Committee of the party. And the party was in charge, and the party did not, would never acquiesce in excesses of that sort. Hungary called for leaving the Warsaw Pact. Hungary called for neutrality, which again was, red cloth for the Soviet bull. We avoided all that because we considered ourselves to be loyal allies to the Soviet Union. And had the Soviet Union found a modus vivendi with our movement, we would have remained the most loyal and most valuable allies.
What particular mistakes did you make that provoked the Soviets found provocative?
Oh, well, the mistakes. I don't know of any mistakes, really. The Soviets were provoked because they were confronted with development which was not in their books. And in addition, the Gomulkas and the Ulbrichts came alarmed that that will endanger their position.
Was the recreation you claimed to be recreating social democracy, was that particularly provocative?
Oh, that was provocative, of course, because the whole policy of the Communist International ever from 1919 was the reunification of the working class. That means elimination of the social democracy. And wherever the communists came to power, social democracy was eliminated by way of unification with the communists and suppression of the rest. When in the middle of 1968 some social democratic people came with the idea to renew the Social Democratic Party, I was against it all the time, and because at that moment I considered it to be a tremendous tactical mistake. Tactical mistakes serving only as a purpose for hostile propaganda from the Soviet Union.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.